fortunate indeed to have today Anthony Beaver, Britain's, depending how you measure it, best-selling, most celebrated military historian, whose books have sold millions of copies around the world. And he's going to be talking to us today about his career and how, perhaps improbably, he has become that writer. Some writers want to do it from the very earliest age, and others fall into it. So which of those, Anthony, is true of you?
Well, it needless to say, took a long time before I was able to look back and see how things had turned out. But it really, in a way, came about because when I was small, literally as a child, I had Perthes disease, which is a fairly rare condition, which means your hip bone goes completely soft. So the ages of about 4 to 7, I was on crutches with my leg in a sling behind my back. And curious to think, of course, in those days, you know, there I was walking to school in London, quite a long way, you know, completely unsupervised. Nowadays, in fact, my mother would have probably been arrested by the social services. But in those days, it was regarded as perfectly, perfectly normal. But the point was that it was sometime later, and I think it must have been probably when I was at school, and needless to say, having been on crutches, you were bullied, that I decided I really wanted to join the army. And this, obviously, it was to compensate, really, I suppose, for sort of, you know, that weakness or vulnerability as a child.
So because you thought that the army would be able to give you physical strength and an ability to have confidence as you walked around, was that it, or was that something else?
Well, yes, it was to a large degree, but you didn't recognise that at the time. You obviously convinced yourself it was for other, other motives, and particularly sort of grander motives of whatever it might be, of patriotism and duty and so forth. But it was only much later, funny enough, when I'd started writing while I was in the army, that I was able to look at myself rather more objectively and realise that actually it all came from that period of Perthes.
So you went to Winchester for your senior school. You might have gone to a more military-based school, dare I say, Wellington. But Winchester, were there any teachers there, please say yes, who inspired you with a love of history or learning?
Well, actually, it was a prep school that I was inspired by one particular history master. Alec Porch, who actually turned out to be the one who Charles Spencer attacked later in his particular book. But he was a brilliant history teacher. I never suffered from him in the way that Charles claims that Lee suffered. But anyway, that was something we disagreed about, but there we go. But at Winchester, no, I have to say that there were not many inspiring. It was not a good period at Winchester in the early 60s. And I was then got into a very anti-intellectual attitude. I was bolshy, and I failed my A-levels, history and English. So from that point of view, James Sabin Clare, later, when he read an article about Anthony Beaver as a late starter and talking about failing my A-levels at Winchester, sent me a note the next day, a very amusing note, saying basically this is not the message we're trying to get across here. But Winchester was not great in that way. My father was a typical Wickhamist. I think Wickhamists of his generation tended to be rather sort of emotionally crippled. He mellowed very much in older age. He was double first in Mods and Greats under Spooner at New College. And of course, when I failed my A-levels, he was furious. I don't blame him. It seemed to be a waste. And so I only really started to educate myself after Winchester.
So it's fascinating. I failed my own A-levels first time round. It's fascinating, this process of late intellectual maturation and what happens I mean, many people with that kind of trajectory would not have gone on to becoming Winchester's, the country's most celebrated military historian, certainly up there in the top two or three. It's an extraordinary achievement. Was it a late emotional development or a late intellectual development? And what was it that started drawing you towards the life of the mind?
On my mother's side of the family, they were all writers. I was actually, it turned out to be the sixth generation published by John Murray, the publishers, going back to some very remarkable blue stockings of the early 19th century, Lucy Duff Gordon, Sarah Taylor, and my grandmother was also a writer, my uncle as well. So, I mean, you know, there was a notion when I started in frustration, partly in the army, to start to write. And I started by writing one or two political thrillers, purely to learn the process. Because in those days, there weren't any of the writing courses like at the University of East Anglia or anything like that. And the only way, actually, to learn to write in those days was to be published and have a very good editor. And I was very fortunate, both, first of all, at John Murray, but then also at Jonathan Cape, to have an absolutely superb editor. And I would come out after 2 hours feeling totally humiliated and exhausted. But my God, I learned more from her than I could have possibly learned, I think, in any sort of writing academy or course.
And indeed, the decline in the general standard of publishers and their desire and capability of actually working on authors' texts and giving valuable comments, apart from the elite of the elite, is that has gone down, sadly. Now, you went to Sandhurst. That was perhaps the closest you came to Winchester itself, 2 miles away. A good experience, and you then left in 1970?
Well, I left and I left Winchester in late 64. I went to Grenoble University and then I joined Sandhurst at the beginning of 1965 and served 5 years altogether in the army. Curiously, of course, that turned out to have been a huge bonus. I didn't realize it at the time. I loved the time with the regiment. I hated Sandhurst, which was very tough and hard going, but I loved the time of my regiment, the 11th Hussars, which was a sort of very friendly setup. And I liked that was where I actually started writing. And as I say, it was the innocence and arrogance of youth to believe that I could be a writer at that particular stage. And purely because there had been members of the family who had been writers, didn't give me some sort of privileged DNA in that particular way at all. And obviously my writing at the beginning was, I was writing, as the editor said, you know, in binary sentences, and it was totally predictable. And it was thanks to her, as I say, that I actually started to learn. And by writing fiction before writing nonfiction proved to be a huge advantage, because it meant that I was able to convey things, if you like, or tended to convey things in a much more visual way. So when it came to when finally everything took off, obviously, with Stalingrad, I was amused and irritated, but at the same time I recognised why, when so many journalists came saying, now, is history the new novel? So I wanted to scream in one way, no, it's not. But at the same time, I realised what they meant, because actually history was changing in a dramatic way at that particular time.
That's so interesting. And few military historians have had that learning stable of being a novelist writing fiction first. And it, you're talking about the way that affected your language and your descriptive powers. Can you say anything more about what you actually learned? And can one old question. Can one learn to be a good writer, Anthony?
Whether or not one can learn to be a good writer, I don't know. I think you can certainly learn to be a much better writer than you would have been otherwise. But sorry, could I please, first of all, correct one little element? It may sound pedantic, but I'm not a military historian. I follow the great Professor Sir Michael Hyatt, to whom we all bow down. We are historians of war. A military historian is only interested, basically, in movements on the battlefield. But a historian of war, as Michael quite rightly argued right from the start, is concerned with the fate of civilians, with everything to do with war. And that is really what we should be doing and are doing. But you're going back to your... Sorry.
And you're doing that... You do that so effectively. And Michael Howard, as you know, was a had been a boy at Wellington College.
Indeed.
And we were all very conscious of his influence and deeply proud of his scholarship at everyone connected with Wellington College. So a historian of war. And can you talk about your first writing, and when did this sense that you wanted to move from fiction towards history come?
Well, surprise, surprise, my novels were not selling very many copies. And publishers, quite rightly, then sort of approached me saying, but listen, with your military experience or whatever, why don't you write about war? And so my very first book was a... It came out in 1982, which was actually about the Spanish Civil War, which I then rewrote later when much more material became available in Spanish and above all in Russian archives and so forth. But the point was that the whole question of, as I was saying, of having written fiction first, obviously did influence the way that I approached it, the way that I wanted to read, if you like, about the subject myself, and enjoyed when you can actually visualize. And I felt particularly for a younger generation who had no idea of totalitarian warfare, but the duty really of the historian of war was to convey its reality and its horrors. And you could only really do that by, not just by statistics or by movement or whatever it might be, but actually by the reality of what it was like at the time. So from that point of view, you can combine two things. You can combine the scholarship necessary from archives, from all verifiable facts. But with certain detail, you can also reconstruct the physical environment, the emotional environment of which soldiers were fighting under. And I think it's terribly important. What we have seen when warfare became a sort of much more controversial subject was that many were attracted to the subject, particularly cultural historians and others coming from social historians, coming from sort of other angles, partly because, of course, it was a very controversial and therefore also an area of war, an area of history which sold well. But the problem was that some of them came with pre-established ideas and an ideological grid which they tried to fix on the subject, rather than understanding or making the effort of empathy to understand why soldiers behaved in the way they were, why they were trained in the way they were. I mean, for example, it was Joanna Burke did a controversial book called An Intimate History of Killing. And that was mainly about sort of the basically believing that she seemed to believe that every man got some form of sexual excitement out of the idea of killing. Well, actually, what one finds in, for example, the Second World War is that the vast majority of soldiers never fired their gun in anger. Only a small, very small percentage actually did the fighting. So you have got to abandon all of your political prejudices in a way when you are approaching a subject like that.
This is so fascinating. Can you say anything before we look at the books about the audience? What is it about war that so fascinates us? I'm just about to take a group of Wellington parents to the First World War battlefields. Many people are deeply fascinated by the First and Second World War. Is that, what is it about? I've often asked the question, Anthony, I don't know the answer. Yeah.
Well, I think actually the answer is fairly straightforward, because war is the most extreme example of human experience. There's no doubt about it. It brings out the very worst in people, it brings out the very best in people. And therefore, from a sort of traumatic point of view, it is, if you like, it is such a challenge that we are fascinated by it. And I don't think that there's anything necessarily dark or mysterious about it in that sense. But it also, there's another thing, and that is we're living in a basically non-judgmental society today. And the whole point about war, and especially, say, the Second World War, is that it presented moral choice, greater moral choices than you will ever find. And moral choice, let's face it, is the essence of all human drama.
Right. The Spanish Civil War was, can you say more about what attracted you to writing the book in 1982? How did that come about? And what did you learn from it?
Well, I've learned from it many things, and I was very intrigued. I mean, at the time, in fact, there was some I got to know some of the old Spanish anarchists who were living in exile in London. And I was fascinated partly, of course, because of course their fight against the communists, which intrigued me. I was also fascinated by the way that, of course, in Spain, being a macho society, that the greatest violence comes from the repression of fear. And this is terribly important. If one is to understand war, you have to understand the relationship, not just of hatred, but the relationship between hatred and fear. And why, for example, how do you get the ability to persuade tens, hundreds of thousands of soldiers to kill, like, for example, in the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941? But that was because Goebbels, with a diabolical genius, realized that if you had to combine hatred with fear to get that particular level of violence and cruelty against a population.
How did that work, Anthony, in the First World War, when there was no equivalent of Goebbels that I can think of on either side? What was it that, and there had no experience,
quite a bit. I mean, remember...
Well, I mean, there was the Boer War.
The babies on bayonets in Belgium and all of that stuff. And British propaganda was pretty ruthless in the early part of the First World War. And also, you know, ditto in Germany. In many ways, yes, the idea sort of, you know, to what degree do you hate your enemy and all the rest of it, hatred can come about pretty soon, and it particularly comes about when you lose a close friend, or you feel that sort of the enemy has taken played a trick on you in some way or other. So it obviously didn't reach the same degrees of hatred that we saw in the Second World War, because it was not so much of a war of annihilation as the Second World War was. But at the same time, I think it would be, put it this way, historians in the past have certainly skimmed over the killing of prisoners in the First World War. There were a lot more who were just shot out of hand, particularly when small groups of Germans were, say, taken back for interrogation. It's quite striking how many actually were shot while so-called attempting to escape.
On both sides?
On both sides, yes.
And has that been fully documented?
No, because I'm afraid, you know, how do you get the details? I mean, basically, staff officers were furious when, prisoners didn't turn up because they'd been shot on the way of being escorted back, because they needed them for intelligence purposes. But, I mean, it was just something that they had to put up with, because it was almost impossible to prove.
Was there anything equivalent in the Second World War, what am I missing, to the Christmas truce on the trenches on the 25th of December 1914? If not, why not?
Well, the Christmas truce was, of course, a totally exceptional event, it didn't last very long.
it
but that was partly because, sort of, there was an illusion that sort of with promises that the war would be over by Christmas. It was a mixture, obviously, of instant war weariness, even at that stage, after only about 4 or 5 months of fighting. But it really did start to disappear. And then by the end, you start to get the idea that because of all the casualties, because of all the losses, you know, one mustn't give in. We've got to defeat the enemy completely, simply because of all the blood that's already been shed. And this is, of course, one of the problems of peacemaking in any war.
Absolutely. And then there was, 1982 was the Spanish Civil War. There was then a gap. I'm sure I'm missing something, till 1990, 8 years inside the British Army.
Yes.
What was happening in that period for you?
Well, I think I was struggling. I was still struggling away, trying to also still to write novels before I was already persuaded that drop those and go for nonfiction. And stick to history. I made a number of attempts. Funny enough, one of the books that I wanted to write at the time, I would have been totally unfit. Thank God they turned it down, because I wanted to do a book bringing together all the revolutions of 1917 to 1920 in Europe, whether the Russian Revolution, Hungarian, German, and so forth. And of course, it was done much better later on by others, but I was not in a position to do it at the time. Anyway, thank goodness they turned that one down, and then they asked me to do something else, and that's when I think I did the book on the inside the British Army, which I rather dreaded when I started it, but then actually it became fascinating because you found that as a microcosm of society, the British Army at that particular time was about and was in the process or just starting to go through a period of extraordinary change. And it wasn't just a question of change with the end of the Cold War. It was also the change in society, the less respectful society, the way that the sons of officers were no longer wanting to join the regiment of their father or whatever. They wanted to go into the city and make lots of money. And this had an effect on the sergeant's mess, where they felt that the officers were not going to be there to look after them and look after the regiment and all the rest of it. And one started to see all of these different currents, which were very much reflective of a wider society, affecting what had been a very enclosed community. It was, shall we say, an interesting signal for the future. I also noted, and it was quite intriguing, of course, that when Mrs. Thatcher came to power, and not many people know this, the generals lined up to go to see her to say, Prime Minister, you must realise that when there was a strike in Northern Ireland, we could not actually hold the fort and run the country. So they tried to advise her not to take on the unions head on. And Mrs. Thatcher was furious. She felt that this was one collective organization trying to protect another collective organization. But it was also the period when, of course, we started to see the disintegration of the union movement at the same time as the social disintegration of the father-son relationship and the, if you like, the regimental inheritance.
And she went on to be a commanding prime minister 3 years later in the Falklands War. Would you recommend, Anthony, the young people listening to this to spend time in the army? Is that a good thing for, or indeed one of the other services, is that a good thing, do you think, for young people today, or has it changed out of recognition?
No, I still think it's a good thing. I think that a short service commission is actually a very useful tool, and I know perfectly well from friends in the city and all the rest of it that they are, as soon as somebody is coming from the army or whatever, and hasn't perhaps been in it for a very long time, but they know perfectly well, therefore, that actually they're getting a very well-trained and reliable person in the vast majority of cases. And so from that point of view, I think an army education as a young officer is a real bonus. And you know, those who are having trouble at the moment, I would thoroughly recommend it if they want to then get a proper career afterwards. It's very striking how many people, and I mean in senior levels in the city, are simply appalled at how ill-educated most graduates are in terms of education, in terms of English, and being able to express themselves. In a way, that is why history is such a, I think, a vital preparation, simply because it teaches you to research the material, to assess the material, to formulate arguments. And basically, that is a far better preparation for most jobs than almost any other subject.
Well, unsurprisingly, I totally agree with you. Your next book on the 50th anniversary of Crete in 1941... was Crete 1941, The Battle and the Resistance. How did that come about? Was that your idea? Was that an author putting it, a publisher putting it to you?
No. It was John Murray, young John Murray, who sort of said after my Spanish Civil War book, he said, why not go for this? And because we were friends with Paddy Lee Fermor, and Paddy had been very much involved in the battle, and certainly also in SOE and the resistance afterwards. Paddy actually had all of the papers which were still secret in the archives and were not available, especially on the Cretan resistance. So from that point of view, I had an immense advantage there. And Artemis, my wife, and I used to go out and stay with Paddy and work through the papers there. I mean, that was just sort of, you know, one particular source, but it was a very important source, and it was the only way that I was able to make it a double book in terms of covering both the Battle of Crete itself and the resistance which went on between 41 and 45.
And you mention Artemis there, the granddaughter of, amongst other things, Churchill's Minister of Information in the Second World War, Duff Cooper. Can you just say something? She wrote a book about Paddy Lee Fermor. Can you say something, for those who don't know, his trilogy of books about walking across Europe in the 1930s, what an extraordinary figure he was.
He was an extraordinary figure, not just an extraordinary figure. He was also one of life's great life enhancers. I think it was Daphne Barth, who was probably in love with him a bit as well, who sort of said, you know, Paddy should be turned into pills so you could take one every time you felt down. And it's true, you know, just a few minutes in his company and, you know, you felt on top of the world. It was an extraordinary quality. But he was also, as well as sort of the joie de vivre and his absolute fascination with learning, with detail and all the rest of it. Here was somebody who, again, was a failure at school, in his case in King's Canterbury. He was sacked, couldn't get a job and various other things. He was about to be forced into the army, which, thank goodness, he didn't do at that particular stage. And he decided, as a 17, 18-year-old, to walk across Europe all the way to Istanbul. And or Constantinople, as he always insisted on calling it. And he, of course, you know, learnt so much along the way because of this passionate enthusiasm for knowledge of every sort. He had a brilliant magpie mind, which I think is so essential. And that is why he also became one of the great writers of English prose. There's no doubt about it. I mean, in everywhere, people will just sort of, some people find it perhaps nowadays almost too Baroque or even Rococo, I don't know. But it's amazing to read his prose, his description. And it is the greatest travel writing probably ever produced, I think, of the three volumes.
And strong recommendation there for A Time of Gifts, the first in his trilogy of walking across Europe. I'm worrying here, Anthony, this is turning into a bit of a recommendation for failing at school.
Well, yes, let's face it.
And
let's face it, everybody who does very well at school tends to quite often have a disastrous life afterwards. But I'm joking.
And Michael Morpurgo, who I'm interviewing shortly, was also at King's Canterbury, like Paddy Lee Fermor, and had a far from glorious academic career. So passing on quickly from that subject, let's go on to your book with Artemis, which was followed 3 years later in 1994 about Paris. How did that book come about? Wonderful stories in it. And what's it like writing a book with your wife?
Well, let's face it. I mean, in a purely ordinary way, let's face it, it's not a great idea to do joint books, because actually you both have to do just as much background reading as the other. So cost, in terms of cost efficiency, is not to be recommended. But it was a huge pleasure. The reason it was originally her book, she'd done this brilliant book already on Cairo in the war, and the idea was to do Paris in a similar way during this particular period. And now the great advantage was we had Duff's diary. Duff was the ambassador. Churchill made him the representative, the British representative, to the French Committee of National Liberation, and therefore to de Gaulle in Algiers, and then as ambassador in Paris, where he was from September 44 until the end of 1947. And it was a fascinating period, because this was the start of the Cold War, and in many ways the Cold War, you could say, argued, actually sort of started in Paris. During this particular period. So he had Duff's, and because of Duff's influence in the embassy, lots of others who were there at the time, everybody from Isar Berlin through to Brigadier Daly, who was a military attaché, who was not a very inspiring character, but every single night he wrote a complete foolscap on what everybody had said at dinner. And you realize then, one of the important lessons to all historians is that actually rumor is as important as fact when it comes to recreating the atmosphere of a time and understanding why people felt the way they did. Because during this period, people were expecting either a right-wing coup or a communist coup at almost any moment on any day.
And do you have a particular favorite story, Anthony, from that book about the liberation of Paris in 1944? The 45, an epic time? And also, did you get to know your Artemis's grandfather, Duff Cooper, the ambassador, well yourself? Or had he died before? He died a long time ago, hadn't he?
He died a long time ago. I mean, you know, I knew Diana, his famous and beautiful wife, Artemis's grandmother, who was an extraordinary character, but also a great writer. I mean, it was quite daunting in a way, you know, marrying into a family where you had Duff Cooper, who was, again, one of the great writers of English prose. His Caliban, I think, is the best short biography ever written. And Diana, who had a very quirky and original approach and her writing, and her father, John Julius Norwich, again, another wonderful writer. Anyway, very rashly, actually, I asked John Julius to look at one particular manuscript before I sent it off to the publishers. And back it came, back with a squiggle in the margin, John Julius, it was rather a purple passage, I'm afraid, where I'd said one is tempted to compare something to something else or whatever. And John Julius wrote in the margin, he said, "This temptation should be firmly resisted." And he was absolutely right. So he was a great editor as well as a superb writer.
And John Julius Norwich there, your father-in-law, writer of still, by a margin, the best book on Venice, apart from much else. And Diana Cooper, a wonderful writer and rumoured to be the most beautiful woman in England, or was it Britain, at the time, Diana Manners. Moving on from that period, 4 years later. But can I just, I've always wanted to know, is it apocryphal or is it true what Duff Cooper said when he was elevated to Viscount Norwich about his height?
Oh, you tell me. I'm not sure if I know this.
Well, is it, Well, in that case, it must be an urban myth. He was a relatively short man, and when he was elevated to Viscount Norwich, Lord Norwich, he apparently said, "A little Norwich is a dangerous thing."
No, I haven't heard that one.
It's almost certainly untrue.
A little Norwich is a dangerous thing. Well,
in Harold Nicholson's diaries. So moving on to Stalingrad, 4 years on. And this was an extraordinary publishing phenomenon in Britain and globally. The idea came when and how, and how did the writing develop?
Well, interestingly, my brilliant editor at Penguin, Elio Gordon, summoned me, if you like, with my agent, my literary agent, Andrew Nirnberg, because I put in a proposal. I wanted to do a book which was, in a way, an extension of the Inside the British Army, which was to look at all the social change that was happening in Britain during this particular period of the early 90s after the end of the Cold War. And I knew that it was going to be huge, because this was the time, actually, when the real problems that we're facing now actually started, when we were in this absolute euphoria after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And when I arrived, she explained that the trouble was that it would make a very good magazine article or whatever, but it would be out of date by the time the book was published, and it would certainly be out of date by any time any paperback version came out. And I realized she was wrong, so I was pretty depressed. And then she said, "But we've got another idea for you. What about doing about the Battle of Stalingrad?" Well, I realized that this was a great idea, but we had very small children at the time. It would have involved months in German and Russian archives. I had no idea at that stage whether I'd be able to be allowed to get at any of the material in the Russian archives. This was, I'm talking about the early 90s, 94. And so I started to make excuses, and they said, in fact, my agent kicked me under the table, basically to signal, "This is a brilliant idea, think carefully." So I went back and I discussed it with Artemis, and she said, "Well, you'd be a bloody idiot not to do it." And that was how it started. And it was four years of work. But it was, as I say, very lucky in timing. And I think that books so often are rather like love, or, everything depends on the right timing. Because Pikoya, the minister of the archives under Yeltsin, had just forced the military to open their archives. And finally, in 95, we were actually able to get at all the stuff which I thought I'd never be allowed to look at in the Ministry of Defense archives out of Podolsk, which, and up till then, only a few months before, had still been a forbidden zone for any foreigner to even enter the city. So it was rather extraordinary. And of course, the Russian military had no idea how to handle the idea. Here was, they knew perfectly well, an ex-officer from the British Army, a former, enemy in the Cold War, who was coming to look at their, what they regarded still as their secret material.
And how did that work, your going through the archives? And did you realize fully at the time what gems you were discovering?
Well, I had a pretty good idea, because when we first negotiated at the Ministry of Defense with the colonel on the general staff who oversaw the military archives, Colonel Romanskiev, and he kicked off by saying, "We have very simple rule in our archives. You tell us the subject, we choose the files." Well, there was no point trying to say, "Well, hang on, Colonel, that's not how it works in most archives," because you knew perfectly well you were entirely in their hands. So I said, "Well, to give you an idea, in the German military archives and in Freiburg, in the Bundesarchiv, Militärarchiv, the most interesting documents are those by outsiders attached to the German army, by priests and by doctors, because they are going to give you an idea, really, if you like, the human condition during the Battle of Stalingrad." So I said, what would therefore be very interesting would be to see the reports of the Russian Soviet equivalent, the Politruk. Well, you say, "No priests in the Red Army." Well, I accepted that, obviously. Of course, they didn't have priests. But, in fact, their political officers, the commissars, and this was where the gold was. Stalin was so obsessed with the idea that he was not getting the proper story about what was happening in Stalingrad, and he didn't trust the generals. And this is why he had a report that was usually up to about 20 pages every single night, which had to be flown back directly to Moscow so that he knew what was going on. And in there, you found everything, the shameful details of surrender, crossing over to the enemy, drunkenness of commanders, whatever it might be. But you also had the genuine bravery, the genuine heroism. And it was already the one place where you actually saw propaganda-free detail of what was going on.
And Stalin himself was, how would you assess him and his importance in that epic struggle?
Well, Stalin's importance was vital. I mean, he was a disastrous leader in 1941 during the Great Retreat, refusing to accept anybody's pulling back, and that's why so many were captured. But by the autumn, by the key period of the Battle of Stalingrad, he'd started to learn to trust the generals and to give them their headway. And by the end, of course, he became a great war leader, far better, of course, than Hitler, who was going in the other direction, who started off with a brilliant instinct, and then actually got to the stage where the British had to cancel Operation Foxley, the plot to assassinate Hitler, because they realised we'd win the war much more quickly with Hitler still in command rather than otherwise.
So you talk, Anthony, about the timing on books, and the archives had just opened up before they closed again, but also you had the soldiers, the participants who were still alive with memories. How did you weigh the importance of oral testimony to documentary evidence?
You're quite right. I mean, the vital thing is, obviously, the more contemporary it is, where the diaries are best of all. Letters, not quite so much, because quite often soldiers writing home tended to suppress the real horrors because they didn't want to shock their own family. And of course, you had to be very, very careful about oral history, particularly after such a long period of time. But it was intriguing. I mean, Anne Applebaum's a very old friend, and Anne and I, she was working on her Gulag book at the time while I was working on Stalingrad. And we had dinner together occasionally and sort of to discuss notes and exchange experiences. And Anne said, is it just because I'm a woman, you know, that when I'm interviewing Gulag survivors, they'll basically say, you know, don't interrupt, I'll tell you what happened and all the rest of it. And I said, no, I get the same thing, you know, even from old soldiers of the Red Army. As far as they're concerned, what one has to understand is that they were humiliated because they had no control over their own fates under a Stalinist society. And now, of course, here they have Western historians coming to ask them about their memories. So I got lots of stuff about, oh, I remember Marshal Zhukov. I said to Marshal Zhukov when he came to the front, you know, this, that, and the other, and all the rest of it. They were reimposing their own pride, if you like, on what had obviously been a very humiliating period for most of them. But the what one found, actually, the women were by far the best witnesses. They had had their eyes open at the time, but they kept their mouths shut. And when you talk to them, you got a far more accurate view of what had gone on, whether they'd been working as nurses, dragging the wounded soldiers off the battlefield, or even operating the anti-aircraft guns around Stalingrad and all those sort of things. And I knew perfectly well that I could actually trust their accounts far, far more than any of the male accounts.
Historian A.J.P. Taylor said oral history, it was just old men, old women, perhaps drooling in their beards or female equivalent. That not your view, but still sceptical, with a degree of scepticism, still a very useful source.
Well, it is, because there are a lot of details which they can still provide you, whether it was the language used at the time or explaining the atmosphere and so forth. But there are details. But you, for example, you just simply cannot trust anything they say from a sort of factual point of view or a chronological point of view.
So, an extraordinary publishing phenomenon. There followed 4 years, only 4 years later, Berlin, the downfall, 1945 and 2002. Had you started working on that before Stalingrad was actually published? What was the process and the origin?
Well, it was more complicated than that, but there was a possibility of doing a biography of Napoleon with Artemis, which had been, but then we got out of that because it's quite obvious that after Stalingrad, one shouldn't jump around and I should do something which was linked. And it was obvious from the accounts that I'd read of Stalingrad that Berlin had to be the next book, the companion volume in many ways. So I did, yes, start on the research. And there I was going back to the military archives in Podolsk with Luba, my wonderful colleague and friend of the last 30 years now. It was quite funny the way that they sort of said, we would like to see ourselves as co-authors. They wanted to know, because at that stage, it hadn't yet been published in Russian. Stalingrad hadn't been published in Russian. And I said, oh, well, it's about to come out in Russian, all the rest of it. Because you had to be that much more careful about breaking the rules in the archives. And I learned the lesson of, I wasn't allowed to take in a computer or a camera or anything like that. So it was a question of working with a notebook, and I found those wire-spined notebooks were the ideal things because you could tear out the pages and put them in your trouser pocket just in case they demanded to see all your notebooks, which happened on a frequent basis because it was still controlled by the GRU, by Russian military intelligence. And they were the ones who came to check my notebooks at the end.
Is there something unique about Russian soldiers, as we see again in Ukraine, that makes them more prone to bestial?
Yes, because
tell me
of the way they're treated by their own bosses, and this goes back a long way, and why again it still happened in Ukraine. I mean, I remember in the 90s when I was there researching, there were 5,000 suicides a year amongst the young conscripts sent to the army, who arrived with the army, because of the way that they were bullied and treated and all the rest of it. And the generals thought this was funny, I promise you. I knew this from the British ambassador, who'd heard jokes about it from, say, for example, General Lebed, who was the great hero of Moldova, other examples. This is the problem. When they treat their own side, often their own people, as we've seen in Ukraine, whether it was a question of the burning of the bodies to make sure that they didn't have too many corpses to take back to repatriate to Russia during the earlier part of that disastrous invasion of Ukraine, they are prepared to treat their own people almost worse or as badly almost as the enemy.
And does appeasing the Soviet Union in 1944... 45, Yalta, Potsdam, and today from the US, does it work? Does that make them more civilized and good chaps or not?
Well, no, I mean, of course, it makes them far more brutal, as we've seen. I mean, we have seen even in Ukraine, we've even seen, it's been reported the number of sort of, for example, the castration of male prisoners. I mean, it is simply horrific, but that sort of pointless torture should be carried out when it's not a question of achieving any intelligence, but simply is part of the sadism, if you like, which seems to be inspired when people have been completely brutalized by their own side before they're sent into battle.
We're going to have to come to a close there. I'm trying to think of a way to bring this together. How does it all seem? Is this what you imagine deep in part of you, that you'd have this career?
Gosh, no, I never imagined anything of the sort. I mean, the early years were a terrible struggle. Whether one would actually survive as a writer, it seemed very unlikely that it was possible. But thanks to great help, my mother and then later on, working with Artemis, it did become possible. So no, I don't think that I ever had any sort of fantasies of future, except the fantasy that I might possibly be a writer, as I say, out of innocence and arrogance. And that's one of the advantages of youth, that you're not necessarily put off in the way that you perhaps should have been by the statistics or the likelihood of actually achieving in the end what I was very, very fortunate to come across or to find.
Well, on every level, it's an inspiring, an extraordinary and uplifting arc of your whole career, Anthony, and it's a great pleasure and honour to have had you on the podcast. Thank you very much indeed.
Anthony, very good to talk to you. Best wishes.